From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how the B117 variant drove up infections, hospital stays, and deaths, even as most of Michigan reopened.
It's defiance. It's an unwillingness to accept what's really happening, how dire the situation is, and this wishful thinking that we can still lead our lives normal and we're going to be okay.
Also, how a new plan for infrastructure might help Michigan's rural communities.
When you're not able to access the internet in 2021, that's a problem. It's a problem for one of the largest drivers of our state's economy.
And we hope you waited for us to take your coffee break. We've got news of a collaborative that matches that perfect cup with perfect songs.
No matter what's going on, even during like the Great Depression, people still needed their coffee and their music. These are things that enliven us and cause us to feel awake and passionate.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how the B117 variant tested Michigan's pandemic success story with disastrous results.
Our community does not understand the severity of the situation. We are talking about reopening restaurants and schools when the new, more contagious variant is gaining a foothold in our community and will likely render these reopenings foolish or impossible. Well, that fell on deaf ears.
More on that coming up in the second half of the show. But first, President Biden's administration recently announced a plan to create new jobs through rebuilding our nation's infrastructure. The White House released a fact sheet last week breaking down how Biden's American Jobs Plan is going to impact the states. That fact sheet noted that Michigan received a D+ on its infrastructure report card. Harsh, but it probably rings true to you or someone who lives near you. From old bridges to roads with potholes to slow online access, infrastructure affects all of us, uniquely so in rural and agricultural areas. Today, we're calling up Chuck Glipstrew, president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. He covers issues in the state's agricultural businesses. Chuck, welcome back to Stateside.
April, it's great to be with you. Appreciate the opportunity.
What kinds of things make up our rural infrastructure in Michigan? Is this just about fixing the damn roads?
Well, it is about that, but it's about so much more. And, you know, when we think about the scope of commerce and economic benefits that come from our small towns and rural communities and agriculture sector, it is a real problem. We face a rural infrastructure crisis here in Michigan. So from our perspective at the Michigan Agribusiness Association, we represent close to 400 businesses that do business across the agricultural value chain. So we represent those trucking companies and railroads that are transporting crops that are grown in our state. We represent grain elevators and feed mills that handle crops that Michigan farmers produce. We represent ag retailers that are local businesses dotted around Michigan that sell seed and fertilizer and crop protection products to farmers to help them be successful. All of those different businesses rely in large part on a functioning infrastructure system in our state. When the roads don't work, when a rural bridge doesn't work and you have to go miles out of your way around it, when a short line railroad has a section of track that can't handle a train at a reasonable speed, when you're not able to access the internet in 2021, that's a problem. And it's not just a problem for rural quality of life. It's a problem for one of the largest drivers of our state's economy.
Why is it these assets have reached such a crisis point?
I think that it is a complex issue. When we talk about infrastructure, it's certainly not simple. And I think it's important to acknowledge that infrastructure investment is not a simple thing to get done. We have had a lack of investment for decades in rural Michigan and in our state's infrastructure systems overall. But the reality is where we are today is a full-blown infrastructure crisis.
Just to acknowledge, we're talking about several different kinds of systems here, roads, but also waterways and the electrical grid, maybe even some digital assets, too. So that's a pretty broad range of things that would have to be reached by any policy initiative.
We need an A to Z infrastructure investment in Michigan. We need to go big. And the reason why is certainly we need to fix the roads, but we need to deal with bridges. We need to deal with rail. Rural water and wastewater systems are in many cases decrepit and failing because of the lack of resources available and the lack of investment over the course of decades. That creates economic challenges for rural communities and for community leaders who want to keep people in small towns and make sure that they thrive. And again, if we don't have access to high-speed rural broadband, it keeps rural communities and our agriculture sector from functionally competing in a global marketplace, number one. And number two, it's a major quality of life problem. You know, certainly we've learned over the last year the need for things like telemedicine access and the ability for your child to dial into a remote learning environment. Well, if you've got good internet access, you don't think about those things. Certainly it's an inconvenience to do remote school. But if you can't access the internet at all, suddenly you have a child that's not able to continue their education, or you have someone like a parent who's not able to access their telemedicine appointment. It becomes very real very quickly. And that's happened for a lot of people the last 15 months, unfortunately.
Does the association approve of the scope of what Joe Biden is proposing?
What we need to see is a historic investment in infrastructure. And the administration has laid out a plan that goes big on infrastructure. Now, MABA is part of a coalition, nationwide coalition of agriculture and farm organizations called Rebuild Rural. Actually had a statement last week that made a couple really important points. The first is that the proposal the administration laid out is a good starting point for Congress to figure out our infrastructure problem. It's good that the Biden administration has laid out the American Jobs Plan. It's good that the Biden administration recognizes that we are in an infrastructure crisis and wants to solve that. What we need is a robust policymaking process in Congress. And the Rebuild Rural Coalition statement also called for a bipartisan bill, one that brings Democrats and Republicans to the table and solves or makes an investment to solve our infrastructure issues in a bipartisan way. Now, whether that happens remains to be seen, but certainly bipartisan legislation would be the preference.
Before we let you go, Chuck, I wanted to ask you about the challenge that's facing all businesses in Michigan right now, including agribusiness, and that's COVID-19. The heat maps are showing COVID infection and hospitalizations surging all over the state, and that includes in farm country. It's certain that the numbers are lower than in the major cities, but when you've got places like Henry Ford Allegiance showing 29 people in its ICU or ProMedica Monroe with 12 ICU cases, it feels like the energy is shifting in terms of how COVID is hitting rural areas. Are the businesses that you know talking about this?
Yes, absolutely. Every day. Our member businesses are leading the way in promoting the safe, effective COVID vaccine. Certainly what we're seeing in rural Michigan right now is alarming. We've seen case rates in places like the Thumb and Saginaw Valley really skyrocket. The same in parts of the northern lower peninsula, rural parts of the upper peninsula. And it highlights the need to get as many shots in arms as possible, as quickly as possible, including in rural communities here in Michigan and across America. So businesses in Michigan agriculture have really stepped up, in my view, and taken a lead role in promoting the COVID vaccine to their employees. And I'll tell you, we've seen strong uptake in terms of a desire to get the vaccine and, you know, member business employees who want to get the vaccine. And certainly we're doing everything we can to help them answer any questions they might have and help them navigate the process so they can get that COVID-19 vaccine just as quickly as possible. And the need for that and the urgent need to get as many people the vaccine as possible is illustrated, unfortunately, in the case rate maps that you can go look at online that show, again, rural parts of our state under serious pressure. We have an opportunity right now with the vaccine to really turn the tide and to get past this pandemic. So a big part of what we do at the Agribusiness Association and many of our member businesses do every day is to promote the vaccine to employees and also let people know that if they have questions about the vaccine, if they're curious about some element of getting the vaccine, or if they just don't quite know the process to get the shot, there are resources to help them. And not a week goes by that we don't reach out to rural communities and to our agribusiness members to let them know that resources are there, resources are available to help them make that decision to go in and get the vaccine. And certainly the state of Michigan has done an incredible job, in my view anyway, to reach out and to make sure that there's resources available and that we're getting shots in arms. You know, the last thing I'll say is I do think there is hope on the horizon. We've had more than 5.7 million shots administered in Michigan, and many of those shots were in arms in rural communities. We need more. That's not enough yet. And so we're really working hard with our member businesses and the communities they call home to emphasize the need to get that vaccine and help put the pandemic behind us.
Chuck, we hear that it's important for people who may be on the fence or may just be waiting, you know, to schedule their vaccination, that it's important for them to have the kind of relationship with a primary care doctor or another health provider that they trust to hear that message that not only is it okay to do this, but you should do it sooner rather than later. Do most people in the ag sector have those kind of relationships in place?
I can't speak by the numbers, for example, to the number of people who have a primary care physician. Certainly, it is extremely important to have, number one, a primary care physician, and number two, a trusted relationship with that person. Certainly, that highlights the overall issues that we have with rural healthcare, which brings us back to the infrastructure and investment discussion. And it brings back the discussion about telemedicine opportunities for people in more isolated rural communities. Certainly, it is important to know where to turn for sound medical advice. And primary care doctors and physicians are a really important way to do that. I would also say that, you know, as we look at lessons learned from the pandemic, again, I think that making sure there is equitable access in rural communities to resources on healthcare is absolutely critical. And so, yeah, absolutely. I think that those physician relationships couldn't be more important right now as we promote the vaccine in rural communities.
Chuck Lipstrew is president of Michigan's Agribusiness Association. Chuck, thank you for your time.
Thanks, April. Appreciate it.
Maybe you're one of those people looking for moments of respite where you can find them during the pandemic. Something as simple as a really good cup of coffee or an uplifting song. What if we told you could get both in one package?
These are things that enliven us and cause us to feel awake and passionate.
We'll explain in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've talked a lot on the show about the various ways people around the state have been coping with the daily stress of the pandemic. Baking, going for runs, making music, reading or writing poetry. But there are even smaller daily rituals that have gotten many of us through this. For Stateside's Laura Weber-Davis, it's that morning cup of coffee. Grinding the beans, brewing a fresh pot, picking out a mug for the day. Such small moments, but still very important moments of joy. When Laura heard that musician May Erlewine was turning her love for morning ritual into an opportunity to raise money for social justice, Laura called her up. May partnered with Higher Grounds Coffee in Traverse City to create a blend unique for May called Shine On. Let's listen to Laura's conversation with May Erlewine and Higher Grounds founder Chris Treeter.
So can I just start by asking how you guys take your coffee and what your morning routine is or your coffee routine? May, how about you?
Yeah, my morning coffee routine can be viewed on Instagram almost every day. And I love to use the Chemex. I love pour over coffee. And I do like my coffee with cream.
Just a regular, a nice dairy cream, not like a oat milk or something like that.
No way. All cream all the way.
Okay, Chris, you're a coffee guy. How do you take your coffee?
I have mine every morning in a French press, and I usually go with a Central American or a Mexican coffee that has a solid body and medium acidity to it.
How did you get into coffee, and how did it evolve into a business for you?
I first got into coffee in graduate school at the School for International Training in Vermont, helping to convert our campus to 100% fair trade coffee after learning about the vast inequalities of wealth and well-being that exist along the coffee chain. And then I did my graduate thesis on commercializing coffee in Mexico, focusing on two co-ops, grower co-ops that were part of an indigenous rights movement in southern Mexico that was combating the ill effects of global economics. And through that, I realized that I had a love for coffee, not only to drink it, but the people who grow it and the cultures who are growing it, and decided to move back to the United States and start a coffee company.
It's interesting. I think of coffee shops and the experience of getting a cup of coffee as not only being very American, but here I feel like it is. For me, it's very much a part of my Michigan experience, having access to great coffee, kind of like having access to great craft beer, maybe. But it's not quite the same because, the hops aren't grown here as they are for beer, right? So you have to source the beans. Can you tell me a little bit about what makes the process feel more local for you?
Yeah, well, 2% of the country's GDP comes from coffee-related work. So while coffee isn't grown here as an agricultural crop, the end processing is completed here, from roasting to quality control to preparing drinks in a cafe or restaurant, and or selling it in the grocery store. So what is really local about coffee is the community that it really cultivates. And I think it's something that is really special in culture of any humanity you find. In history, too, you go back in time and you see gathering points being old coffee houses that led to the French Revolution. And today, a coffee house is known as the third place in between work and your home. So for me, the locality really has to do with the culture, as well as the 2% of the GDP that it generates for our economy.
So, May, when we look at the sort of things that are delightful about coffee and the experience of having a cup of coffee, it often does intersect with music, especially if we're having our morning coffee and we have our music on at home, or we're driving and drinking our road coffee and listening to music in our car, or sitting at a cafe or a coffee house somewhere listening to whatever soundtrack they're providing at the time. So they really are a happy and natural marriage. Can you explain from your perspective why those two things maybe seemed so essential this past year?
Yeah, great question. I think throughout time, and you mentioned the craft brew as well, like beer and coffee and music have been constant. No matter what's going on, even during like the Great Depression, people still needed their coffee and their music and their beer, you know? So these are things that enliven us and cause us to feel awake and passionate, you know? And I think a lot of that comes down to ritual and practice, where, you know, we have these same times every day where we meet and we make our coffee and we greet our day, or we meet at the end of our day and we have our craft beer with our community. And so these things are reminders that we're alive and awake and living this life together. And they do, like Chris was saying, they are like kind of center points for people connecting to each other, which is also, we're mirrors for each other, you know, and we need each other to feel whole. So community is so important, and these things are embedded in our community. And music is something that just kind of lifts anything we're doing. Music enhances it because it causes us to be in touch with feeling. And it also, it triggers different things in our brain than a lot of other things do. So music is like very cathartic, important part of living. It helps us to feel life more fully as well. So they all sort of, to me, are very similar in their way that they cause us to be in a moment, you know? And that's why I love the coffee ritual and sharing it, because it's like, it happens every day, but it is a sacred thing.
So can you explain how you got involved with Higher Grounds in this project?
Well, Chris and I have known each other for a really long time. I, you know, was a young songwriter coming into the music scene in Michigan, coming up, you know, through the support of my elders in the music scene in Michigan, and very much wanted to use my music for purpose and as a, you know, being of service to community. So I was always drawn to other people who are operating that way with their businesses or with their nonprofits. And so I came to know Chris as sort of a figurehead in the community who was doing really deep work in the world that was beyond just his business, that, you know, was diving deeper into human rights and also trying to connect communities, like this global community we have, trying to make connections in a way that I felt like was so respectful to everyone involved and also so progressive. So I've always admired Chris's work, and he's so passionate and open in collaboration. And so we've collaborated a lot over the years, and he's an artist himself in the way that he has vision for what he's trying to do. And so I think it was a natural friendship. I feel very lucky to call him my friend, and I feel proud of the work we've done. And this, you know, when it came time to make a coffee blend, it made sense to do that with Higher Grounds because of our relationship, but also because of the work that they do and how much they care about human rights and the sort of humanness in the growing coffee to the coffee enthusiasts appreciating it. So I really, it was a natural synergistic thing that we did this collaboration.
Chris, you know, having tasted now the Shine On blend myself, I'll tell you, it hits me in the perfect place in my palate for coffee. It's just a delightful, very lovely cup of coffee in the morning. Can you explain a little bit about this blend?
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of the that flavor profile that you're enjoying when you drink the Shine On blend is truly a collaboration. And the Shine On blend is part Ethiopian Sidama, as well as part Huaybol Honey Peru from Central Cafe. The Peruvian in it is honey processed, which means the outer cascara, as it's called, the shell of the coffee bean is left on it during the drying process for a time, which allows the sugars to really sweeten that bean and give it a unique flavor profile. So that brings out the bright elements of that coffee. And you'll find notes of brown sugar, honey, and plum jam naturally within that cup profile.
Chris, can you talk a little bit about the work that Shine On is doing outside of the mug, if you will, the work that it's doing on a philanthropic end?
Definitely. So the Shine On blend raises money for Title Track, which is a Michigan-based nonprofit that works toward racial justice. And personally, I feel that's very important in our time and space that we live in today. And the meaning of the song Shine On, which May can speak to, really resonates to what our country has been going through.
May, can you talk about Shine On?
Shine On was written in 2004, and it was at a time where I was very disappointed with the direction of things here in this country, and I felt very powerless.
Knock me off of my feet, but I think it's time for me to start walking again. Stop running away from it. Next time you see me, I will be singing a new song. I am learning to shine on.
And I felt very small in my own ability to create the change that I wanted. You know, it's like that quote, we must be the change we wish to see. Well, I wasn't feeling like I knew how to be that. And so the song was written in a sense of despair, but the idea behind it that I was reaching for was like, okay, well, I need to just start small. And even if I am small, I'm gonna start doing the small things I can do within my community. And eventually that will bring change about. And so the song was kind of in that moment of desperation and also willingness to continue. But it kind of took on a life of its own. And that's why I love writing songs. I love music so much because, you know, I write the song and it doesn't mean anything until it starts moving through the hearts of other people. And that's when music becomes magic, is by touching people and moving people to do things. And so I wanted to bring the song in collaboration with this coffee to kind of encourage people that even though it's been a very challenging time in so many different ways, that we can continue to allow the light that's in us to keep burning brightly, and that it does matter, that we matter and our work matters, because it seems like we need it more than ever right now. So that's sort of the message we were hoping to bring forth with this collaboration.
Chris Treeter and May Erlewine, thank you guys both so much, and congratulations on Shine On. It's delicious, and I hope that we are raising a mug together at some point, you know, in the not too distant future.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
That was Stateside's Laura Weber Davis. To find out more about the Shine On blend or the work behind it, visit highergroundstrading.com. The forests of northern Michigan are home to a wide variety of trees and wildlife, and to hundreds of piles of illegally dumped trash. From couches to toilets to roof shingles. If it belongs in a dumpster, you can probably find it in the woods off of some state highway. Like so many things, the pandemic has only made matters worse. Interlochen Public Radio's Maya Reeder has more.
Just south of Traverse City lies Hoosier Valley, an area known by locals for its natural beauty. Blair Town Hall Road rides right along the valley, and the deeper in you get, the more you sink into nature. The road shifts from pavement to gravel to a dirt path. Beside the road, there are smaller trails branching off into the woods. These are two tracks, largely unlabeled back roads traversed by four-wheelers, snowmobiles, and pickup trucks, and people who come to Hoosier Valley to dump their trash.
No, it's disgusting. It's not very pleasurable.
Ray Levitt recently bought a four-wheeler and has been riding it up and down the two tracks with his son.
I'm kind of disappointed.
Yes, I'm disappointed in the people, and I'm upset with the people that are doing it, because I don't believe that they're making an effort to find an alternate way of getting rid of it.
For years, Hoosier Valley has been the target for dumpers. Its secluded paths in close proximity to Traverse City make it an easy place for people to unload unwanted trash. In the last year, Ray Levitt decided he had enough of the trash in Hoosier Valley. He was going to do something about it. Ray and other members of the community organized a cleanup day in early April to clear out the valley for the spring. Today, there are around 40 volunteers here. With donated trucks, they haul two large dumpsters worth of trash out of the valley. Ray thinks some of it even showed up last night.
I think people knew that we were going to do this, and they hurried up and dumped stuff at the last second. A lot of furniture, tires. I think there was one bathtub. I think somebody said half a boat.
But Hoosier Valley isn't the only place in need of a tune-up.
Well,
pretty much every
place
there's two-track.
We're from Fife Lake, and there's a lot of two-tracks and snowmobile trails around us, and they seem to be a dumping ground as well.
That was Michael and Chris, a father and son duo who came in for the day to help with the cleanup. They've traveled around the state to clear out illegally dumped trash. Connor Haney helps organize events like this. He serves with AmeriCorps for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. The DNR has a database of around 600 reported illegal dump sites. It's an interactive map that even details what kind of trash is at each site. Connor says the state relies on volunteers to clean them up.
There's no designated cleanup crew for the DNR, and Adoptive Forest is essentially myself and my supervisor who manages the program.
Last summer, the DNR hosted a 100 in 100 challenge to try to clean up 100 dump sites in 100 days. Volunteers responded to the call, going above and beyond to clear out 151 dump sites. Adopt a Forest helps volunteers organize, but doesn't have a budget for equipment or to pay for hauling trash. The state didn't pick up any of the costs for the Hoosier Valley cleanup. Ray Levitt owns Affordable Roadside Assistance out of Traverse City, so he has a truck to help clear out the valley. But the waste still has to be properly thrown out, which can be costly.
I hope we get everything, because a lot of money out of my pocket.
Proper disposal of four old tires will cost you $60, $15 per tire. Mattresses or box springs are $30. The couch is $30 to $45. For business owners seeing less customers during the pandemic or folks furloughed from their jobs, these costs quickly add up. So it's not surprising to hear that tires are the most common item across all the sites. Couches and mattresses are other repeat offenders. But Connor Haney says it's not just the financial burdens of a pandemic making things worse.
With people spending much more time at home than recent years, they're generating more waste within their home and they have less money to pay for proper disposals.
Some counties and townships provide free disposal sites on certain days a few times a year to try to get ahead of the issue. Hoosier Valley's Blair Township is one of them, but Ray says they aren't making that much of a difference. Long-term solutions are hard to come by, so Ray and other organizers are getting serious. They've donated deer cams to cover certain entrances into the valley in hopes of catching folks in the act, or even deterring them altogether.
It's not going to stop here. I'm going to keep going. I really want this to end permanently, and if I got to come off monthly budget to help me come up with a way to do that, I'm going to do it.
That story came from Interlochen Public Radio's Maya Reeder. In January, the message was clear from public health officials.
We are talking about reopening restaurants and schools when the new, more contagious variant is gaining a foothold in our community and will likely render these reopenings foolish or impossible. Well, that fell on deaf ears.
That story after a short break. You're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's hospitals and public health officials are pleading on their social media channels and through press releases, asking people to keep up with public health recommendations. Please do continue to wear masks. Please do continue to practice social distancing, even if you've been vaccinated. With case rates and hospitalizations as bad as they've ever been in Michigan, a lot of people have been wondering what happened here in the state that was one of the first to flatten the curve. Turns out there is an answer to that question. A reporting team has published an extensive article in Sunday's Detroit Free Press that talks about the spread of the B.1.1.7 variant and some of the decisions that were made around it. Joining us now are Teresa Baldus of the Free Press and Derek Kravitz. He's with the Brown Institute for Media Innovation's Documenting COVID-19 project. Teresa, Derek, great to have you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
A lot of us have seen the national heat maps showing Michigan glowing red hot now, while the rest of the country's cases are a little cooler, yellow or orange. What were you hoping to learn at the outset of this project about the latest COVID surge?
Essentially, as with anything, the big question we're always looking for is, were we warned? Did we know about this? Or were, was Michigan hoodwinked? Did this just surprise everybody? And so the first thing, we set out to figure out here at the Free Press and the folks over at Columbia is, when did this first show up and what was the response? And as Derek's team can attest to, they did some amazing FOIA work and got the early emails, contact tracing notes, state data reports, interviews with local health officials. And what we were able to first and foremost pinpoint is that we were not surprised by this. This was here. People knew it. People warned about it. But instead of, getting more stricter or clamming down, everything opened up.
This is a big picture story among a year of big picture stories. Derek, could you tell us a little bit more about how you structured the reporting, maybe which regions you targeted and what kind of questions and requests you were making?
Sure. So we just focused on the places that we had been hearing about and reading about as having variant outbreaks and issues with the spread of the virus. And that included the Bellamy Creek Correctional Facility in Ionia. And the spread of the virus there amongst staff and prisoners. And that also included the University of Michigan campus in Ann Arbor with students getting infected and spreading it to the larger community there. But then there were other places that we didn't know about, including in the Thumb region. We spoke to several experts there that told us about how that was spreading in workplaces and at homes and there we found evidence of spread at a dairy farm, at an insurance company, at several daycare facilities, a lot of high schools, a lot of youth sports, a lot of basketball teams and student athletes. And I think what was most surprising to us wasn't just the spread of this variant, which is way more transmissive, way more deadly than the original strain of COVID, but really was the push by parents, by some local officials, by others to just keep reopening, keep relaxing the rules, less and less quarantine days for people. That really surprised us when we read about that.
The resulting story is grim. Teresa, would you say there's a short answer for why the case rates are so high right now?
I think it comes down to what it's always been in Michigan, and that's defiance. Initially, we started out with folks who just didn't want to follow the rules. Now we have people who were once compliant, just tired, COVID fatigue, and not following the rules, wishing and hoping this thing were over. And, you know, in my opinion, based on everything I've seen, it's defiance. It's an unwillingness to accept what's really happening, how dire the situation is, and this wishful thinking that we can still lead our lives normal and we're going to be okay.
Let's start off with the team's reporting on Washtenaw County, which is arguably one of the most educated and affluent communities in the state. As some folks will remember, the University of Michigan identified a cluster of the B.1.1.7 variant here on January 24th. What happened next?
To me, that is the most compelling argument about what happened in Michigan. You had a cluster of students that the university finds this cluster of students, and they issue the warning. They raise the red flag right away and said, listen, we're concerned about this. And they raised it before the county public health officials. In fact, one of the best quotes, and it was in an email that said, our community does not understand the severity of the situation. We are talking about reopening restaurants and schools when the new, more contagious variant is gaining a foothold in our community and will likely render these reopenings foolish or impossible. Well, that fell on deaf ears. The local health department said, we've thought this over and we're going to reopen anyway. And they did. And we know the rest of the story.
Right. Were you able to find anything more out about why the county health department declined to issue a shutdown?
Yeah. So on that point, there was a lockdown on the U of M campus back in October. They thought about doing the same thing, a second lockdown in late January. And after consulting with the Attorney General's office and the State Health Department's legal team, they opted not to do that lockdown. And that was even despite the Washtenaw County Commission Chair, Sue Schenck, pleading with the Health Department to take this more seriously, to lock down. Why they chose not to lock down the campus again? After consulting with those attorneys, they were told that there could be a potential for a lawsuit. And on top of that, the county health department wanted to balance, a lockdown with, the spread of the variant, which is already in the community and already circulating. So there's a rational argument for that. But the legal argument is a tough one to swallow. I mean, the potential for a lawsuit against the state affecting a public health decision, that's not an easy pill to swallow.
The story notes that it was rare for anyone in Washtenaw County to be ticketed for big parties, Super Bowl gatherings, or similar violations. Did you find out why?
Yeah, that's a hard one, because when the county health department wants to figure out what's going on, they need names, they need details, they need times and dates and who to talk to and issue a fine or a ticket. And if you don't give a name, if you just see people congregating in a common area and watching a Super Bowl party but not wearing a mask or distancing, that's not a lot of information to go on. And that's what we included in the story, that they need a little bit more detail there. And so, hands are tied.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Derek Kravitz with the Columbia Journalism School. We're also talking with Teresa Baldus of the Detroit Free Press. They're part of the team that reported the story appearing in Sunday's Free Press on how B.1.1.7 gained complete control over Michigan. Let's talk a little bit about some other parts of the state. There was another cluster that emerged around a state prison in Ionia. And this piece of the story is tightly focused on one corrections employee. She had several COVID tests and was determined to be carrying the B117 variant. Can you tell us a little bit about how she reacted when health officials got in touch with her to try to trace her contacts?
I think, based on the contract tracing notes and the interviews and the emails we were able to obtain from Columbia, she was resistant. She wasn't cooperative. She went to work not knowing for sure if she was infected, even though there was one positive test. And when they did try to reach out to her, there was difficulty. They couldn't find her. They couldn't get her to talk. And even when they went to her home ultimately and let her know that you have this variant, this highly contagious variant. And sometime after that, she ultimately called the local health department. And the reason she did is very compelling. Her mother contracted the virus. Her mother was hospitalized with this. And I think that speaks to what happens a lot of times. We don't take something serious until it really hits home. And then what ended up happening is her mother, 2 weeks later, died from the virus.
Do we know if this employee was the only staffer at Bellamy Creek in Ionia who might have been spreading the variant? I don't want to lay too much responsibility at the door of this one person. I'm not sure from the story if she was some sort of patient zero for the variant.
So, no, it's not clear if she was patient zero, but there were a lot of MDOC employees who did test positive for the variant and then who spread it to, others, including spouses, a third grade teacher at a local elementary school, a 911 dispatcher. There were other employees who tested positive for the variant. But then on top of that, there are a lot of contact tracing notes where state employees are resistant to staying in quarantine and to telling the local health department about who they have exposed the virus to, contact tracing. And that presented a lot of problems because then the health department doesn't know how fast and widely the variant is being spread.
The story also spends some time looking at high school sports. We should maybe say middle school and elementary school sports as well, and notes that the state at this point is aware of more than 1,000 infections of COVID. And I believe the B117 variant that were transmitted at various K-12 sports practices or events. Teresa, do we know if that's the extent of the spread?
No, as the state health department has said many times, given people's reluctance to be forthcoming with contact tracers, we don't know the complete picture of the spread of the virus in sports. They've just updated for the first time their website with some very strong statistics that break it down sport by sport that shows where the infections happened. Basketball being the number one. Since January, we've had almost 400 COVID cases involving high school, middle school basketball games. And then of course, hockey second, wrestling, and we broke down the numbers for it. Are there more? They are updating it. We're about to see, but I do think it's very, very telling that when we're getting early reports at, this B117 variant was in Michigan in early January, and the kids went back to school shortly thereafter. There was an order lifted that we could have in-class lessons, and it was half and half. Not all kids were in school, but then a few weeks after that, the governor lifted the order on sports. And by then, this was by early February. It had already, done its thing.
There's one aspect of the B117 outbreak that the story doesn't exactly explore in detail, but that I was really curious about. You outline how, you know, people, by declining to participate with contact tracing, by making their own decisions together with others, how they, you know, how people had a part to play in this. But there's this question of the gray area in which the legal response had a role in shaping people's opinions. The state's public health infrastructure, including Governor Gretchen Whitmer, has done something of a 180 since last winter. Whereas last year, there were lockdowns through the springtime even, the focus now is on personal responsibility, asking people and businesses to mask up, asking them to avoid gatherings. There were some inferences in the article that there were concerns about lawsuits, but how much do you think legal repercussions had an impact on institutions and maybe even individual people's reactions to COVID?
You know, there's one compelling thread that we found throughout all of the seven counties and the thousands of internal emails and memos we obtained, which is you know, people, when you're dealing with a variant outbreak or the virus, people will do the bare minimum usually when asked how long to quarantine, who to identify that you've exposed the virus to. And what we found, especially with parents of high school athletes, they were lobbying their local health departments to reduce the amount of time that they had to quarantine at home from 14 days to 10 days to even 7 days, and lobbying the local health department to reduce the amount of space to socially distance from 6 feet to 3 feet. Which is for students, but is not meant for the entire public at large. And these local health department officials were, you know, fed up and tired of dealing with angry, aggressive parents, to the point where they went to the state health department and asked them to toughen the quarantine guidance, to keep it at 14 days, and to make it clear to people that they need to abide by the rules. Otherwise, this type of out of control variant spread is just going to continue.
So I think I'm hearing you say that the effort to ask people to take personal responsibility, I think I'm hearing you say that that has not been successful to this point in the pandemic.
I think you'll see a lot of people trying to return to normal, trying to basically have life continue in the way that it did pre-pandemic. We aren't there yet.
What do you hope that people will take away from what you found?
It's what we've been reporting all along. Listen to the health experts. Look at these numbers. Before, people weren't following the rules when there were rules. And now we're asking you to just be, okay, you're not being forced to do this anymore. You're being asked, urged to do this. And we're hoping that this reporting highlights to people how serious this is, and to take it upon themselves to listen to the medical experts and wear your mask, socially distance. It's not reporters saying this. It's not politicians saying this. The doctors, the hospitals, they're begging the public to listen. And hopefully, sometimes people respond better to, okay, you're not telling me I have to do this. You're asking me to please do this. So maybe by asking instead of mandating, that might work. We don't know. But I wanted to weigh in on what you mentioned earlier, that our governor has taken a 180 on this. Let's not forget, she has faced immense public pressure and criticism over how she's handled this pandemic. People who have thought that she was too aggressive and too stringent with the rules. But, you know, we have a vaccine now, and that's what she's hanging her hat on. So, and also asking people to follow the rules, to continue to be cautious. You know, we're hoping that people will consider listening to medical experts. There's this vaccine. Get the vaccine. So, you know, the government, I don't think, wants to shove rules down their throats anymore, but they're saying, we're asking you to do this. There's a vaccine to help us, and please consider doing both. I hope that point gets across.
Teresa Baldus is a reporter with the Detroit Free Press. The paper's journalist worked with Derek Kravitz and others from the Documenting COVID-19 project with the Brown Institute for Media Innovation for this project. You can read their article online at the Free Press website. Teresa, Derek, it's great talking with you. Thanks for taking some time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow this time.